Accession number 22346, Rule 1.
Captain Riggs, Rule 1. Was there a tradition of military service in your family?
No, my father was a sea captain who qualified under sail, and throughout the First World War, he was at sea, of course, and so there was no military service as such. But I had an uncle who was in the Artists' Rifles in the First World War. He was an artist and served with people like Alfred Leet and Stanley Holloway and all those people who were artists in their professional lives. And so when I was leaving school at the end of 1937, we all of us were heading for, mainly for the Territorial Army or one of the sort of weekend soldiering or something of that sort. So I applied to join A, the HAC, which would have cost me £5, or the Artists' Rifles, which would have cost me 10 shillings. That wasn't really why I joined the Artists. It was mainly because of my uncle's connection with it, which I joined in early 1938, only onto the waiting list because they were said to be full up. And it wasn't until the Munich crisis, when the Territorial Army was doubled up sometime in 1938, that they then took all of us off the waiting list, because the Artists was not doubled up exceptionally. The Artists, the HAC, the Westminster Dragoons, and the Inns of Court were predestined to be officer training units in the event of outbreak of war. But to avoid us being caught by the Militia Act, which was 1938, I expect, when 18-year-olds were conscripted, they brought us nominally onto the strength rather than being on the waiting list.
So you were on the roll.
So I was on the roll, yes. I had been accepted. So I put the uniform on properly, and not until sometime, even early 1939, sometime in the spring, if I remember rightly.
Can I ask, had you done any military training or pre-military training?
Only at school. I was in the OTC, yes, yes.
Can you remember what sort of training you'd done in your school OTC?
Well, pretty rudimentary. It was mainly just sort of a bit of drilling and a bit of, arms work and so on. We weren't a bad school, actually, at shooting. I was at Magdalen College School at Oxford that time. We did very well in the Ashburton. Although we were a very small school at the time, we used to come four or five sort of thing every year in the Ashburton Shield, mainly because we had a very keen master who'd got an MC on the Western Front sometime or another, and he was he got us all working. I wasn't number five in the Ashburton Shield, I hasten to say. I could never hit anything.
Do you remember if you did any tactical training?
Very little. They used to take us off on marches and things up in the Lambourne Downs. It really wasn't. It was only sort of one afternoon a week sort of thing in the school curriculum, in the school timetable.
You mentioned the master who'd got an MC on the Western Front in the First World War. Do you remember him discussing what he'd been doing during the war?
No, he never mentioned it very much. We had, of course, nearly all our masters had been in the First World War, but this is, I'm talking about 1935, 6, 7. And none of them mentioned it particularly, I don't think, no. Not that I can remember.
Did you have any expectations of war as time went on? Do you remember?
Well, of course, the Nazis had already taken over,
yes,
Germany in the earlier 1930s. And it's only one what one picked up. But playing cricket and trying to get into the second 11 was probably much more important than worrying about any prospective war, although many of my seniors who we stayed in contact with had already gone into the Territorial Army or the RAFVR or whatever, and some of them had actually gone into regular forces. had taken on regular commissions and things like that. So there was a sort of a track, if you like, out ahead of us. Actually, I was going into the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank and heading out to the Far East. I was accepted for that when I was still at school. My parents were in Shanghai at that time.
Did you have any idea about the way in which a war might be fought, about the weaponry that might be employed or
no.
techniques?
Like everybody else, the same as the last war. And of course it didn't turn out that way.
You said that you headed for the HAC or the artists. Mm. What was it that moved you to want to join the territorials?
Well, as I say, most of us did this, certainly if we came to the London area or somewhere like that. Everybody was joining, contemporaries of mine joined the Queen's Westminster's and this, that and the other. And it was just something one did, you know.
Matter of fashion then?
It was following the herd in some ways, I suppose you could say. It was not any sort of seething patriotism, although it was in one's blood a bit more than it is today, in 2001, we all reckoned, we were going to be heading into some sort of territorial unit or something of the kind. And so in I went, but the artists accepted me, and so there I was. Mm.
Did you do any training with them once you'd
with the artists?
On the role? Yes.
Yes, we had a. Each company had an evening throughout the week. B Company was Wednesdays or something like that. So Wednesdays one reported to the drill hall at Duke's Road, you know, behind St Pancras Church, which the artists originally built for themselves in the mid-1800s, somewhere, with their own people. They'd got architects and raised their own money, as this often happened. Though when the MOD sold it, we didn't get any money, if I may say so, but that's by the by. Once a week, but it was usually sort of drill and a bit of preliminary weapon training and not a lot else. We had a fortnight's camp every year, of course. I only did one at Warminster in Wiltshire, which will figure later on in what I have to say to you, much later on. It rained nearly the whole time, and we were under canvas. And so they pushed us into some barracks that were half-built next door, which I think were being built for the RAC as tank barracks. They were great hangars and things like that, but at least we slept on concrete uncomfortably rather than in mud. But that training was mainly route marches. In fact, there was a piece of paper somewhere that I saw where there was a criticism in the paper about officers-to-be wasting their time just marching about the streets instead of being trained to be officers. If I can find that, I'll let you have it. You might find it interesting.
Did you do any sort of proper field training while you were there?
Not that I can remember. No. No. No toots or anything like that.
What about minor tactics? Did you do anything of that sort?
No. Mm. I can't. Not that I can remember. No.
What happened then when war broke out? Did this have a
well,
great impact?
Well, on the 2nd of September 1939, I got a dirty little piece of brown paper signed by the adjutant saying that the king had, by royal proclamation, had embodied the territorial army into the regular army. And the next day I was told to report to Duke's Road to our... And we set off immediately for a holiday camp on the south coast for children at St Mary's Bay near Dymchurch, which was fine because it was a nice heat wave for the first 2 weeks of September of 1939. We spent most of the time in the sea, I think. But then soon after that, we were moved to Risborough Barracks at Shawncliffe, which I think were originally a sapper unit was in there, but they pushed them out. And our training started properly then as an OCTU. I think at that time we were designated as 163 OCTU. And we had quite a number of the instructors turned up from Sandhurst. And we didn't touch the ground from then onwards very much. It was, it got a bit serious, the training.
Do you remember what was on the syllabus, what you were taught that, well, stuck with you?
Again, most of it was sort of lecture room stuff, I think, as far as I remember. And we used to go up onto St. Martin's Lane. I remember they tried to teach us to drive, and we ruined quite a lot of vehicles being taught to drive, because I was only 19 at this time, and many of my contemporaries were... that's tautology, isn't it? were about this 19 or 20 years old. They graded us then into companies in the OCTU, so that the older ones who'd been longer in the TA spent only perhaps a week or two or three before they were commissioned away. But I was with the babies, if you like, the youngest group, and we were commissioned eventually in just before Christmas in 1939. And then all the original artists had gone then.
Do you remember what sort of tactics they were teaching you?
I don't remember very much. Again, we used to do a bit of sort of patrolling and a bit of map reading and, you know, what do they call it these days? Orienteering.
Orienteering.
Running
across country in one point.
That's right, and finding where you were, yes. And we spent a lot of times with the one-inch ordnance survey maps, you know, 1/63,360, I seem to remember. you know, we learned all the conventional signs and so on. Not much use in the desert and the jungle later on, but we'll talk about that in due course.
Well, the four subjects normally are drill, weapon training...
A lot of drill, yes.
...field craft and map reading.
Those I got 14 days CB while I was there. Because we were issued with new rifles, and we were told to get them well cleaned up for a CO's inspection the next day. And being keen young cadets, we all... had the barrels of our rifles shining beautifully, but I forgot to clean the breech out, which still had grease in it. So I got 14 days CB for having a dirty breech in my rifle on CO's inspection. But taught me a lesson or two.
Were you the only one who got punished on that?
I can't remember, actually. No, I think there were one or two others from time to time who got CB, but...
Did you find the discipline difficult to accept?
No.
Came naturally?
We were very young, you know, and we were keen. We weren't just sort of pulled into the army. We'd got some sort of, what's the word, ethos, if you like, at the time. And we still had our regimental cohesion, if you like to put it that way. And although we all knew we were going to be... commissioned away into other regiments.
Did everyone manage to complete the...
There was one man who didn't, and I heard that he shot himself. I've always remembered that. He wasn't in my platoon. I didn't know him particularly well, but we heard this afterwards. But otherwise, I think everybody got commissioned away into other regiments. At that time, I think I mentioned we could choose. I was living at Harford at that time with an uncle and aunt of mine. As I mentioned, my family were in Shanghai.
Yes.
And I played cricket with some of the guys who were in the Hertfordshire Regiment, which was a territorial regiment of the Beds and Hearts. The Bedfords, I'll call them from now onwards, because it's a long string of a name. And so I said, yes, I'd like to join the Hertfordshire Regiment. And the colonel of the regiment and the local solicitor, John Longmore, who was commanding the 1st Hertfordshire... No, there wasn't a 1st, it was just the Hertfordshire Regiment at that time, interviewed me and said, okay, we'll take you on. And so I was designated to be a second lieutenant in the Hertfordshire Regiment in December of 1939.
When you were interviewed by the colonel, do you remember what sort of things he asked you?
No, they. I met them in some club somewhere up in London. I can't remember which one it was even. And I didn't know much about clubs in London at that time, at the age of 19. And they talked to me whatever they talked to me about. I think I didn't go through any sort of rigorous. It was all rather sort of old boys sort of network, you know. And who did I know in and around Harford? And my uncle had been in the Hearts Yeomanry in the First World War, and they would have sort of known one another a bit, you know, and that sort of thing. And I heard that they said they'd accept me, and so I headed for the Hertfordshire Regiment. But when I was commissioned, I went straight to Kempston Barracks in Bedford, because that was the depot for the regular regiment. And I never saw the Hertfordshires again. It so happened. So that's the artist's phase. If there's any more you wanted to ask me about that.
Do you think you learned anything in that octo which stood you in good stead later when you were in the field?
Well, I suppose so, yes. It gave one some self-confidence, you know. One, although there was a lot of drill and that sort of thing, we had to take charge in turns from time to time, you know. They tried to make something of us as commanders with a very small C. And, of course, once I got to Bedford, I got a bunch of recruits to look after.
Yes.
And so, again, one got into an officer routine, if I could put it as simply as that, including orderly officer, of course, at 2 a.m, turning the guard out, all that sort of stuff, you know.
When you got to the Bedfords, how were you received on first arrival?
Oh, all right. You know, I wasn't anything unusual by this time. There were their own territorial officers and others who were sort of put in there until they were eventually disposed of to other more operational units, or sent off hither and there, or sent on courses, whatever. So I turned up with another guy in the artist rifles, who I'll mention to you in a moment, a man called Teddy Ablett. So we turned up together, and also almost at the same time, one of our officers from the artist rifles, David Muirhead, he was there, but we were there for about a month, I suppose, and then the adjutant sent for us, and he said there are 4 cards face down on my desk, 2 red ones and 2 black ones. The 2 red ones will go to the 2nd Battalion in France,
yes.
And the 2 black ones will go to the 1st Battalion in Palestine. And I picked a black one, and Teddy Ablett picked the black one. David Muirhead went to the but he was involved with SOE later on and strange things like that in Gibraltar, and eventually retired as British ambassador in Brussels.
But were you happy to be going out to Palestine?
Well, yes, anything was exciting. The phony war was on at the time in Europe, of course, in France and not Belgium, but in France. And, you know, one had then been conditioned, you went where you were sent anyway.
Did you tell?
And it sounded interesting. Ablett and I took the first draft out to the 1st Battalion.
You were saying that when you go back a little bit, when you arrived at the Bedfordshires, they gave you a platoon of recruits to deal with. What sort of men were they, your first platoon? What do you remember about them?
Again, basically very young. Many of them, of course, had been conscripted under the Militia Act, because that brought in 18-year-olds in 1938. So they'd been about my age. I was still only 19. Time, and they were very young and very pink. So was I suppose. But again, it was mainly the NCOs at the depot who, and one used to stand around, you know, with a swagger cane under one's arm, saying "Carry on, Sergeant," or something. And he did much of the, particularly with basic weapon training and things like that, and. It was mainly that sort of thing, and a drilling, of course, and the odd sort of route march. Nothing across the Brecon Beacons or anything of that sort, but sort of up and down the roads around Bedfordshire. It was extremely boring. It was very, very cold in that first winter of World War II. You know, we had petrol freezing in the trucks. And but that was just by the by. That was the way the weather was. And by February of 1940, I'd set off with a draft of about 40 or 50 reinforcements for the 1st Battalion in Palestine.
When you met the recruits. I mean, one of the things an officer has to do is to establish a rapport with the platoon he's got.
I don't remember one of them.
You don't remember any of them?
I'm sorry.
And what about the sergeant? What sort of fellow was he?
Well, they were mainly regulars, of course, and many of them were older ones, too, who had served time with the battalions, the 1st or the 2nd battalion, over the years. Some had been in India, because that's where the 1st battalion came from, to Palestine for the 1938 Arab rebellion. And so, you know, they knew their stuff all right, these guys. And there were some of the older officers were running the depot, you know, older majors who were getting near to retirement and that sort of thing. We were only there a very short time, a matter of two or three or four weeks, I suppose, altogether. So we never really got into any great sort of routine.
And then you were off to?
Then we were off to Palestine.
How did you get there?
Right. Now, as I say, we were designated or posted there, and then we were given a draft of about probably about 30 to 40 men as reinforcements. Some of them had been in the Hertfordshire Territorials, I remember, and they were wonderful guys later on. They got stripes on their arm, no time at all, once they got out to the battalion. But I'll mention that a bit later on. Because they had been just started their working careers, you know, in whatever they were doing in civilian life. And they came from, you know, Harford and Hemel Hempstead and Dunstable, all the drill halls, you know. And they were a good bunch of guys. Anyway, we set off from Bedford by train for London, and we were put up for the night in Wellington Barracks, of all things. And they said to us, that's to Ablett and myself, they said, can we go out on the town? And we let the whole lot out, and the whole lot came back again. In retrospect, it was a fairly hairy thing to do, but none of us really knew quite what we were doing, nor that we were going to be abroad for 5 years, most of us, anyhow.
How old were these men that you were?
Well, they were my sort of contemporaries, most of them.
19, 20, 21
years. And they were fine, and we set off across the Channel by train to Marseille. Snow all the way. In fact, they were shoveling snow off the quayside in Marseille into the harbour when we embarked in the Duchess of Athol for Alexandria.
Did you manage to get any sort of impression of France as you were going?
Not really. I mean, I suppose it was probably a 24-hour journey stuck in a train. Cold weather, the windows would have fogged up anyhow. And we'd already got into a condition which we had for the next 5 years of just going where we were sent, you know. And so there's nothing notable about the journey out, I don't think. It was very nice to get into a ship with lots of lovely food to Alexandria. We had no escort at the time, I don't think, because, you know, the phony war was still on.
Italy hadn't yet entered, which might have made a difference.
Hadn't got much navy anyhow, I don't think, to spare at the time. And so we got to Alexandria, and then we went by train up into Palestine, and we were picked up at Lydda or Tulkarma, one of the stations in Palestine. The battalion was at Nablus.
What impression did you have of Egypt? Presumably this is your first visit to.
Well, much more later on, which I'll tell you about. But really, again, we were stuck and put in a train in Alexandria, and we didn't go out into the city there.
Yes.
And so we just found ourselves, ended up being told to get out at Tulkarm.
Mm.
Probably, usually, it was an overnight trip across the desert, the Negev desert.
Did you have any idea about what was going on in Palestine before you arrived there? Had you had any
nothing that I could remember? No, yes. Not at all. It was quite quiet there. The sort of Arab rebellions and things of 1938, as soon as World War II started up, they died right down. In fact, there were only about 3 battalions in the whole of Palestine at that time. But I'll mention that again in a moment. Anyway, we joined the battalion in Nablus, which even then was quite a big Arab town, holy Arab town. And we were billeted in buildings throughout the town. We had an internal security role, but it was pretty mild at that time. We used to go up into the hills and visit the villages and that sort of thing, just to sort of show ourselves, but not in any aggressive kind of way, usually with a Palestine policeman who could speak Arabic.
How were you received on these visits today?
Oh, fine, yes. We weren't aggressive with them, and we didn't push them around or anything like that, and they'd got used to it because it was happening all the time all over Palestine. You know, one would go around, visit about six or eight villages and come back again. And but I ended up in a company of the 1st Bedfords. The company commander was a man called H.C.R. Hose, known as Socks, of course, to everybody, to us behind his back, but to his contemporaries as Socks. He was a welterweight boxing champion of India in his day. And we arrived, he said, right, get your kit off, and there's your room in this billet, and I want you outside in shorts with boots on and your socks rolled down, and nothing else. It was still quite cold in Palestine at that time. Nablus is in a sort of defile, the town itself, and there's a mountain each side. He said, right, cut hike. And so we said, what's that? Which was an old Indian game of running up mountains, which the Gurkhas still do, just for the fun of it, you know.
Picketing the heights.
Hmm?
It was useful when you had to picket the heights for a mobile column.
Well, this was the Northwest Frontier.
Northwest Frontier
tactic, of course, yes. At any rate, I nearly died trying to get up the top there because I wasn't all that fit one way or the other. However, that was Socks Hose. He was a great keep fit man and a brilliant sort of character who did wonderful things later on, which I can mention to you.
Why weren't you fit? Hadn't you been given physical training in the battalion?
Nothing rigorous at all. At the depot or anything like that. Nor were the artists, if I remember rightly. There was a fair amount of lecturing went on, lecture room instruction, one could say, at Risborough Barracks, but we never went on 20-mile route marches that I can remember. So, you know, I was fit enough, but not as much as Socks Hose required.
What about the other chaps who went out with you? What about Ablett? Was he fit? Or?
Well, he went to another company, which had a less energetic company commander, so he was better off than I was at that stage of the game anyway. But this was the sort of guys that we had. But we were the first wartime people to turn up, so we were all regarded. And I think he wanted to take the mic out of us a bit too by running us up and down the mountains.
Now, you joined the company. Were you given a platoon straight
yes,
away?
Yes, straight away.
And what sort of men were in that?
Well, they were all regulars except for one or two of the people that I brought out that were put right round the battalion in all sorts of roles. So they were all pre-war regular soldiers. I don't want to run them down. Some of them were marvellous guys and proved to be such, but their education standard and so on was not very good for reasons I can't really explain, but you know better where recruits were gathered in for the army, and a lot of them out of sort of borstals and orphanages. And I mean, they weren't all sort of ex-criminals, I'm not suggesting that, but you know, the social structure of the nation in the 1930s was such that a lot of poverty and education wasn't very good for the lower classes, if one could call them that. And you know, one or two of them couldn't write. We still had one or two guys who were illiterate. You know, they didn't grow up the way children do today. Perhaps I could put it that way.
How did you get on with them? Because you were from a different world.
Oh, fine, yes. I mean, we had most marvellous NCOs, of course. The regular NCOs were great. And of course, the time scale of promotion in the pre-war days was much slower. A man was a corporal for 4 or 5 years, and before he became a sergeant, perhaps. And they used to have to pass
written exams in those days,
yes.
Which soon went by the board in wartime. We had one sergeant who was an absolute marvellous guy, but he was almost illiterate. We just couldn't promote him.